Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Andrew Dickens, a man who, for a period in the early 80s, was both the station manager and the breakfast show host. Andrew talks about how BFM set him up for a career in radio that would take him all over the planet and in which he's still active today. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Andrew Dickens.
Hello. I'm still getting used to the fact that I'm not in the old studio. And in fact, I'm on the other side of the building. And in fact, you've got four studios now, and we only had two before. So it's lovely to be here. Haven't been here since 1988. What? I was here last time in this building. It's been lovely coming up the back steps.
I'll take you back to the start. When was your first involvement with BFM?
All right, well, I was a grammar boy. And came to university in 1981 with my great mate Andrew Hawthorne. We're inseparable. We're a couple of post-punk brats from Grammar who came to university and went, "Whoa, look at this! This is fun. There's loads of people, and it's, you know, and mufti." And he started disappearing off halfway through 81, just before the tour. He started just disappearing off. Where's he going? And he obviously had some little secret hidey hole, something new, you know. And eventually he admitted he'd been going up to see Campus Radio, which it was called then, not Radio B. And I went, that's right. I kind of knew of Campus Radio because it was only on for a couple of months, 6 weeks in the year. And I kind of knew of it, but I thought, well, that sounds interesting. Can I come along? I don't think he wanted me to come along. It was his new secret and his new mates. And maybe he was trying to dump me. I don't know. So eventually he relented and I walked in to this small little space, and there was a couple of very bookish people there, and we just started hanging out, and before I knew it, I was sitting in the studio playing some records. So that was midway through 1981.
And seriously, it was only 6 weeks. It was on air during orientation and the beginning of the year.
I think it had been on during orientation. I think occasionally it got a warrant to be on during the Easter tournament. But yeah, that's all it was. And so when I joined, it was very small. It was like the debating society or the archaeological digging society and all those other societies that university has. It was just a little bunch of people. And I'm talking, there was Mike Brady and Florence and Neil Mushet and Dave Reed and Andrew Topping and Scotty and a few other flows on. But there was about three or four people, and they have four offices, four rooms, and they just hung out in there and played with records and fussed around doing something. So it wasn't much happening, you know. And occasionally people would come in and just spin some records out in the quad. So, yeah, very small little affair.
So even if it wasn't broadcasting out generally, it was always plugged into the quad speakers.
Always into the quad. And Hawthorne and I came in and kind of took it over because this was fun. Fair to say that university, I was doing a law intermediate, doing science, and it just wasn't fun. And what would I rather do, you know, sit in a studio? The big thing about Campus Radio was 3,000 records. You know, you walk in and it's all over the back wall of the studio and it's just records. And we were 18 and we had no money. I had 20 records at home. I had Joy Division Closer, and all I did was play that the whole time. And I think I had 17 seconds from The Cure and Aladdin Sane from David Bowie. And suddenly I walked in and there's like 3,000 records. So what would I rather do, you know, go to a lecture or sit there and just work my way one by one through each of the albums and introduce myself to all this music, and a lot of it I've never heard before, never heard of before. I remember pulling out Linton Kwesi Johnson and going, what the hell is this, you know? And so we just worked our way through the record collection out into the quad and educated ourselves. So.
The music that the other people were playing on BFM at that time, it was good music? It was okay? I say that because there are stories of sort of BFM in the 70s and they didn't play good music.
Yeah. Well, because I came right at the beginning of the 80s, it still hadn't come into an alternative radio station at all. It had aspects of that, but there was still some prog rockers there who liked to play some Yes. Some of the older guys had been around for a while, so it was still in transition. Good music, yeah, but not always. And I do remember, just jumping ahead to 82, in the first week of broadcast, we had a breakfast announcer, Jimi Hendrix was his name. Hendrix as in a Scandinavian Hendrix, not like the man. And he ended up being a record company representative. And he was sitting there, he played Dire Straits on the breakfast show, first week orientation. And Andrew Topping, who was the PD, said, I wondered how long it was going to take for that to come out, you know. So there was a little bit of that. But certainly with our invasion, Hawthorne and Dickens and then Bishop, and Boak was already here as well, but on and off, and he was all over the shop, you know. We started bringing a little bit more, you know, We're going punk. We're going new wave.
Prior to the Andrews, BFM had really embraced punk rock. But after the Andrews were here, it was...
We went total.
Yeah.
But that's not to besmirch the reputations of the guys here before. Mike Brady and Andrew Topping were very heavily into their alternative music. Mike was very much into reggae. It just, when you've got a volunteer organisation, and it was very much a student radio station then, students, you know, engineering students, I'm sorry, they just were not getting the Cure. You know, they just weren't. And so you had to put up with Genesis.
Presumably you had to convince someone that that would be a good idea to let you play some records.
There's no difficulty whatsoever. None at all. Like I say, because we weren't broadcasting on air, there wasn't that super pressure to check quality and check what's happening. And if somebody came in and you became an acquaintance and they said, oh, he looks like a decent enough fella, we can trust him, he's not going to steal the records, right? You could have a crack on air. And you didn't have to talk. Because what was the need? But you did anyway, because flip cards with announcements, you know, the Chess Society is meeting right now in level 3 of the Student Union building, you know, boom, in comes another record, you know. So you do a little bit of that, but no pressure. You could just pop on and... Yeah, so very relaxed at Radio B at that time. And I'll tell you what used to happen in my day. I used to get up at 8:15, living with my parents. They'd go off to work, you know, about 8 o'clock, so I had the house to myself. I'd get up. It was hard times. We only had a bath, pour a bath, and then I'd go in and put Joy Division Closer on, side two only, and play that. When that finished, that was out, get into your clothes, get in your bike, come into university, go to Radio B. You know, I was going to play from Closer Heart and Soul, but I thought better of it. The funny thing is, when I bought the CD of Closer the other day to remind myself of the good old times, I put it on and went, what the hell is all these tracks? I don't recognise a single one of them, you know. And then I realised I'd only ever played side two, so there we have it. But the track I decided to play from Joy Division, which, you know, was the band that turned me from Fleetwood Mac, is Transmission. Yeah, 81 continued, and Mike Brady was being thrown out of university for insufficient academic achievement, as we all have been. And Andrew Topping had moved on to Radio Pacific, and he was doing the he was panel operating in the afternoons. That's his job. It's still his job now. He's been doing that for 30 years. And so we needed a new management. Assistant station manager was Andrew Boak, and we all thought that he'd move in. Andrew Hawthorne was obviously going to be programming in some area or another. And so we waited to see who was going to take over the in the power vacuum. And Boak, of course, was doing the regulators, and I think it just started No Tag then. And had an active nightlife, and so was seen scarcely around the radio station. And I thought, hello, this guy's, he's not doing anything. He's just going to walk into this job. I thought, I'll give him a bit of a scare. I'll put my name in for the station management, and he'll go, ooh, and he'll start doing some work around the place and get into it. So apparently they had a meeting, and Andrew Topping came to me the next day and said, congratulations, you're the station manager. And I don't want to be the station manager. I was 18, all I wanted to do was play some music, smoke some drugs and come to the university and ask about, but no, you've got the responsibility of it. So that was that, really.
So who decided? Was it?
There was a board that decided it, and I think they just pulled a, but there's only two names in there, so away we went. Now, the thing then, of course, was that the year before we had applied for two short-term licenses in a row. And the Broadcasting Tribunal, under Bruce Slane, a wonderful man and a great friend of Campus Radio, Radio B, BFM, had said to them after they got two in a row, they said, you don't want some more, do you? You're okay? And they went, yeah. And Mike and Andrew sat there and said, what's he saying? Is he hinting, that we should go for some more? So when I got the job as station manager, the next week, Mike and Andrew came up to me and said, right, your first job is to apply for next year's licenses. And we're thinking 10 in a row. It's never been done before. 10 short term, February to November, do it. And I was 18, I had no idea. So I went to the AUSA and they said, get a lawyer. So we got a lawyer. And I started just doing an application on a manual typewriter, little keys, click, clack, click, clack, clack, paper, all this sort of carry on. Worked my way all the way through the application, just answered every question, had no idea what I was doing, no training, nothing, Went to the lawyer, said, well, how's this? He said, that looks really good. That looks really great. Great, great, great. So how long do you think this is going to take? He said, well, I have no idea. I've only done liquor tribunals, but I'm sure a broadcasting tribunal is exactly the same. So we had a hearing in the Southern Cross building, and I was too nervous and too young to front it. So I got Mike Brady in to do it, and he turned up in a shocking pink tie and a terrible shirt, and he was quite theatrical, was Mike, and so he was reading this great Radio B application. Oh my God, I thought this is a complete cock up. And within a couple of hours, Bruce Slane said, you got 10 in a row.
Wow. Which so is each one lasted a month.
Yeah, 28 days, but they just all strung it all together, and that was a revolution. And it was obvious. It was a policy decision by the government. They wanted alternative radio. It pissed the commercial guys off. They'd spent hundreds of thousands on lawyers and tendering for frequencies, and we got given one for free. And so, the only thing then to do was to get the thing on air and make it happen. And that was one of the greatest summers of my life. It was loads of fun because we formed this little working bee of, four or five of us. I went down to Sweetwaters and worked down there building the stage for a holiday job, and then came back at the end of January. And we had to, if you're going to broadcast, you need an aerial. So I had to find one of these, and luckily Dave Ree was there and said, JDA, and we booked it all, but we had to put one up. And we'd put it up on the roof before of the building, but we decided that wasn't good enough. You've got to have wet feet for a transmitter. You've got to put it down by water and preferably low and with hills around to make AM really work. And the university had land down in Hobson Bay, so they said, we own the land. We asked ourselves if we didn't mind putting a transmitter up, and we said, yes, of course. And so we had this great weekend with all these punk rockers down there digging damn great holes and pouring concrete to make the stays that hold it up. And then the transmitter slowly was winched up. I had to hire a crane. Where do you hire a crane from? Had the crane, and this leaning tower came all the way up, and it was up. And I always loved that transmitter. For the whole 3 years, I used to have to ride past it and went, that is a symbol of something. It's a build. I built that, and it's working and it's pumping. And every now and then I'd go down and check all the dead animals that had been electrocuted by it at the base, and A lot of people never get this in their broadcasting life, to turn a radio station on. It's great. And I can remember the week beforehand, we're feverishly putting that red masking tape on the sides of all the records, and we're sorting out all the singles, and we're figuring out all the index cards so we knew where everything was and how we were going to program the radio station and how many announcer choices and how many programs and all this sort of thing. And then suddenly there's this glorious day at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Monday, we just turn it on, it's on, and it's just great. And we're away. Well, for the first 4 months, it was good. 7 to 10, 10 to 1, 1 to 4, 4 to 7, 7 to 10, 10 to 1, turn off. Not on overnight.
1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, turn it off. Turn 7 it o'clock off. In the morning again, turn it on. So that, right. That's all it was. So, you know, Jimmy did this show and everyone had a show. And, of course, there was that moment when all the announcers were waiting for over the summer period, will I be on air? You know, and that's when Andrew Topping would come and wave his magic wand and tap you on your shoulder and say, well, I've decided after much consultation, you are going to be on air. Yes, yes. So, yeah, so we were fine at first, but and I kept myself off air. I was like a floater, and I just thought that was sensible. But, you know, within a couple of weeks, I was on almost every day because people were falling down. And there was one show I always did was the 10 to 1 show on Thursday night, because they were putting Crack'em to bed just along the hallway. And so I'd be playing music for the Crack'em guys, you know, and the Crack'em guys were really fond of their whiskey, and the B guys were really fond of their cannabis. And so we'd have an exchange of stimulants. And I look at the Crack'em guys, I think they're changing the world. Those guys are changing the world. And me, I'm just playing some punk rock. You know, and then at 1 o'clock, we'd all stop and steam off to John Reynolds' restaurant, John's Diner, and just talk shit until 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was great. You know, I really felt young and vibrant and changing the world. And it was good stuff. Yeah. At the same time, the revolution of B, which goes all the way through, is that you can actually talk in your own voice and you don't have to be the jock, you know, that sort of stuff. You don't. And so as long as we were making sense, and as long as we weren't talking too much and we were playing lots of music, you know, it was cool. And I was a bit strong on, you know, play the ads, could you? Huh? Mm, please, we're trying to pay for things here, and that's all. But they were a very responsible, nice group of people. For all the fact that it's all, you know, punk rock and all that, this is a group of very nice, well-balanced, strongly motivated, middle-class people who, you know, were very responsible. And I remember in that first year, we had very little thefts of records and stuff, because we're such a small core group, you know. And as it started massing out and strangers started coming on, you know, then you started getting a few problems that you had to sort out, you know. But no, there's really no problem. But that said, in terms of keeping people on, by the second half of the year, I was doing the breakfast show all the time. and this is how professional we were. I rode a bike in it all the time, and I'm not good in the mornings, you know. And I'd be arriving at 7:07 in the morning for the turn on, you know. And Reginald Perrin was big at the time, so I'd be like, sorry about that leaf mold at Clapham Junction. I'm 7 minutes late, but I didn't get where I am today by being on time. And I understand that people listening, you know, used to, they'd turn on the radios at 7, you know, and they'd sit there tensely going, what's going to happen? You know, when's he going to be on? You know, and the first song I'd always do, a really loud song, just go, so the radio really did just go, I'm here, sorry, I'm late, whoa, let's go. Can we play Alternative Ulster? It's 7 o'clock in the morning, okay, and let's play some Alternative Ulster.
Seven,
Stiff Little Fingers, alternative Ulster. Johnny Was, very important song back in the 81 and the Quad days, and also Sweet Jane by Lou Reed. Very long songs which sent a signal out to all the beers all around the Quad, and suddenly you go down to the speakers and you'd see them running from all corners of the Quad because they knew what was going down. Sweet Jane was definitely joint going down up by the speakers. Now, Johnny was either big joint going down because it's 8 minutes long, or cops arrived, go, you know.
So. No, Johnny Was signaled that the dealer was now had arrived.
Okay, there you go.
So anyone who wanted to score, now was the time to go down to the Quad.
And there was a guy called Captain Green, who I still see on the streets of Ponsonby, you know, and he still says, "Hello, Andrew." And he'd come out of the Waitakere's, you know, he had bones in his beard and his little, he had a little paralyzed mate, and he'd hump them up all the stairs, you know, and open up his jackets, and there was all these bags in there. And for the young generation, you got to realize it wasn't skunk or any, you know, it wasn't that sort of stuff. It was cabbage. And so the whole thing about Radio B over that period of time is it was all gently stoned and a cheerful, happy, off its face punk glee club. And I can't remember a single argument. I can't really remember bad times, and I can't remember sex. It was just punk. I read the news in 82 as well, and a terrible story about a man who in Christchurch, who lived by the lagoon, who went out to park the car, went over the edge, fell in and drowned, and was not found until 3 months later. And unfortunately, I was reading the news at 8:30 in the morning, and I thought that was one of the funniest stories I've ever heard. You know, and so I'm sitting there. Well, there may have been mitigating circumstances why I found it so funny, but I'm sitting there and just laughing and laughing and going, the poor wife, he was right outside the front door and she's thinking he's run off with some floozy. Oh, dear, you know. It was great. And that's what it was like.
Speaking of the ads.
Terrible.
In that first year as station manager, you guys made some money.
We made some money. I don't quite know how. I believe we made almost $20,000 profit over the course of the year, and the AUSA were very happy about that. You got to realise we were rating really well. You know, there was only 7 radio stations in Auckland. We were rating 4 and 5%. And that these days, you know, major radio stations are making huge, you know, making a lot of money, millions out of that. So all the stations were so similar that we just got this instant rock audience. There wasn't a rock station there. So we were finding it relatively easy to sell. Plus, we did the Mountain Radio 2XO thing, which was 6 weeks down at Oakuni, where we got paid a lot of money to go down there, write off a couple of cars, be involved in a liquor robbery, what else, break someone's femur, and rack up a $1,500 a week Contra account at a nightclub and live in caravans and have fun. You know, and that provided us with the buffer. So, yeah, we made some money. And the other guy was, we had Brian Faulkner, who started off in news and then saw money-making potential. And he was a great salesman. And he is now a very successful children's book author and has been big in IT. And he's got the gift. And he made the money. And I'm forever grateful to him. And Vicky Haraway, who helped him, who also did the news. They were a great little team. We used to go down to, Andrew worked at Radio Pacific, so we could go down to Radio Pacific and Wirree in the AUSA Bedford van, rolling around in the back, and we'd do 30 or 40 ads in a night, just nail it through, and then ticky tour all around Auckland. And it was a good bonding exercise, got everybody together. And anyway, we had a cart machine. It was one of our, it's a big expense. You know, the gear was amazing. You know, it was a desk, and it had slip pads made of plastic with a little electromagnetic thing knocked up by Dave, I think, you know. And so when you hit the button on the studio, the clamp released and the record started. And newbies, of course, wouldn't wind it back far enough. So every record would go. And the desk always, the left channel kept on falling out. So there's a certain spot in the desk which you went bang. Percussive maintenance. Oh. Thank God we're in AM. You know, if we're in FM, you would have lost the right-hand channel the whole time, you know. And so,
Dave was a good technician.
He's brilliant. Yeah, very good, very good. And he went on to do technical work for Radio Haraki and become a producer. And he got into the internet and, you know, he's very, very clued up. When Dave found Rick, it was sort of like, oh, thank God for that. You just don't get those skills, you know. And he knew there was someone to pass the baton on and he could walk away and actually have a life. And maybe Rick has just not found his Padawan. Or maybe he just likes being Yoda. You know, I don't know. But, yeah. The skill level, you do need a certain skill level in crucial jobs, but the rest should be just, you know, who cares if there's a mistake, you know, but you do need a good technical director. That's quite handy.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, and the other way we made a profit is we sold ourselves off to Sweetwaters in the 83 summer, and that made us get through January. That meant that the entire radio station went down to Sweetwaters that year in a big tent, and we stayed backstage. And that was the year of the Psychedelic Furs and Simple Minds, and so we hung out backstage with the Psychedelic Furs, and remember the Butler twins coming in for an interview, and you know, that flaming red eyes, and me and Hawthorne sitting there interviewing them, you know, and somewhere miles away a little portable cassette recorder that's plugged in, and this rambling, amazing conversation that solved the entire universe, you know, just a freaky conversation. And then we get to the end, and of course there's no battery. You can see there's no batteries in the recorder, you know. The Butlers thought that was hilarious, and they hung out with us all weekend, you know. And Jim Kerr from Simple Minds was off with Chrissy Hine from The Pretenders, and their caravan was shaking around, and you know, we thought, oh, it's just great. Yeah, but so 83 came along and we had to do it again, and it's fair to say that things didn't quite go so well. We ended up making a loss that year of around about $20,000 or $30,000. So that's when reality bit and we realized that volunteers and part-timers have only so much oomph. Bills just kept coming in after we turned the machines off, and I forgot about those ones, and I'm thinking I might move on anyway, which I did. So, you know, it was starting to get to be a grind, to be brutally honest, and I knew that we had financial problems, and it was causing ructions. Like, for instance, I'd actually, doing a deal with concerts, I'd say, we don't want any free tickets for staff, because I wanted the money, because it was getting that desperate, and I'm sorry, you know, hard call. But of course, you know, some of the volunteers, you started seeing the muttering in the corners of hallways, and I'm sure many station managers have seen that. And you're like, man, that Dickens is not good. Yeah, he's got to go. And I thought, well, it's time to go. So many great songs. It's a terrible thing. Terrible thing, Patrick, asking to choose, but, you know, got to do some Kiwi stuff. And the great Chris Knox and Rebel. Thinking of you, Chris. Thinking of you always, mate. The whole thing had changed from the Glee Club to suddenly being quite professional to, and that, because we're on air, kids were getting inspired by hearing it on air. And I didn't realise how many people were listening to us and how many people even knew who we were, you know. And apparently we became quite intimidating. I mean, people would turn up to to campus radio, and they'd say, from the radio. And I'd go, whatever. And so apparently it became a lot harder for people to get in, because if we didn't instantly sort of acknowledge them, they go, oh, they don't like us, and they'd disappear off. Now, some great new young Turks had come in, James Schoening, Chris Esther, Ted Hurlock, and all those people. Bishop was there. Andrew, he'd already been there for ages, one of the five Andrews. And Francis Hooper had come wandering around as well. And Debbie Gibbs had obviously come in and was looking like, you know, the heir apparent, just immediate. You could just tell that she wanted to run stuff, and she was great. I had the great honour of teaching her how to be a DJ. And she had a little squeaky voice, you know, and all this sort of thing. And she actually said, how do I supposed to sound on the radio? And I said, and to my great embarrassment, you know, I said, well, you know, you've got a squeaky voice, so maybe you get up close and whisper, or maybe you get far away and squeak, you know, I don't know, but try and sound either excited or alluring, you know. And I'm always embarrassed about that, because I always should have said, Debbie, you just sound the way you are, you're great, which would have been a much better thing to say. There was loads of girls around. Tara Barker was one. She ended up editing Company magazine in England, and Vicky was around the place, and Catherine Anderson was around the place. There was the Jude Unruh. So, you know, it was a lovely, healthy bunch of new guys, but they were so sweet to look at. You know, they were so keen, you know. And James and Chris were always the guys who did the Sounds Unlimited run. And Sounds Unlimited, very important in those times, because Robin down there gave us a Contra account, and we could go down and get their imports. Now, straight off the boat from England, you know, the stuff you can't get anywhere else. Very, very important. Of course, everyone talks about how good that was, but Robin was charging us like $30 a pop for each record, right? So it was very, there's a lot of Contra, and we were rating 5%. He was getting a lot of advertising out of this, and he was buying a £2 album and selling it for $30. He made a lot of money from the imports, you know. But I loved, you know, watching Chris and James and Ted and others, and they do the Sounds Unlimited run, which meant they could go down and you could say, well, you know, you've got, you know, you can get 20 albums and all that sort of thing. And of course, they'd come back, and that would be some rare deleted B-sides of the Exploited. And you go, what the hell is this record? This is crap. We've got half these records. What did you spend $20 on this on, you know? Or they'd come back with, you know, fabulous new records that just blew our mind. Let's play a record, actually. Let's play Totally Wired, The Fall, which I seem to remember came in one of those import things, and we went, what is this?
Totally wired.
Yeah, the Fall. Main Street.
A Fall in a Hole.
Yeah, Main Street, what a great venue. And Radio B was always up there. You know, we were either doing talent quests and stuff like that. And the gigs at that time were just amazing. The birthday party, all 17 minutes of it or whatever it was, you know, and Susie and the Banshees and
Dead Kennedys, Simple Minds.
And New Order, of course, yeah. with the famous one. Where
John Cooper Clarke opened for New Order.
That's right, and all great. And we got to talk or at least meet with most of these bands. And, you know, for young kids, it was amazing. I remember 82 was quite, we knew we were getting somewhere when a record company phoned up and said, Elvis Costello is coming to town and he wants to do a radio show. Nobody else will have him. Will you? And we went, yeah. And Hawthorne and I said, well, look, we'll do it because, you know, we're in charge here and we want to. So it was like a Sunday. And he was down at the Big Eye, you know, the Hyatt now, Hotel Intercontinental. Elvis will need a car. And I went, oh, that's cool. I've got a car. I'll come and pick him up. So, because the car I had was my parents' hot Austin Maxi with hydroelastic suspension, orange. It was an orange car. And yeah, so it turned up, and Elvis came out looking like a rock star. I was gobsmacked, and hat, you know, long coat, you know, just smelt beautiful, clean, you know, pudgy hands. Go, oh, wow. And he said, where's the car? And I said, here it is. It's the Maxi. And, the manager goes, Elvis doesn't do Maxis. And I went, okay, well, look, the studio is actually 150 yards down Princess Street here. You know, why don't we walk and talk? It's a lovely day and get ready for it. Elvis doesn't walk. So I got in the Maxi, they got in a cab, and we came down. And then he came into the studio with Andrew Hawthorne and played it. And we were just blown away. He was playing lots of soul. He was in that soul phase after Pump It Up. And Neville Brothers, you know, and it was just beautiful. But we knew if Elvis was coming to us, you know, the mountain was coming to Muhammad and all that sort of carry on. It's great. Yeah, BFM, of course, helped John Cooper Clarke and New Order secure their supplies, you know, at the Barry Court Motel in Parnell and Gladstone Road. Funny times.
And what were your aspirations yourself? Well, where were you going to go?
I just wanted a job. That's all I wanted, money. I'd been, you know, $16 a week for the last 2 years.
Did you graduate? Did you finish your degree by then? Or?
No, two papers in 3 years. That's a third of a year's study. I've got four mixed and insufficient academic achievement. So, no, I needed a job. Andrew Boker got a job at 89FM. So did Andrew Hawthorne. And so that sold out. And I went, okay, I'm in. I am so in. And so I went to try and get a job, and I went to Radio Hurricane, I went to a few other places, and unfortunately I found things very difficult, because when 89FM had launched, it was the first FM station, you know, 50,000 watts of power, top half with John Hawksby, decided to get some reaction as to what, you know, the radio station was like, and so they came to me, and they said, what do you think of 89FM? And I said, such a pity to be given so much power and such an opportunity and to waste it on such crap music. And I remember Tony Amos, who ended up being a friend, watching that at the time and saying, does this fella ever want to work in commercial radio? Will we ever get a job? And it didn't work. And the other thing about that interview was that my parents were at home watching it. They didn't know that I was the station manager of the radio. And they thought I was still studying for law and I was doing quite well. And so when I got home, they went, Andrew, come and explain this.
What have you been doing at university every day for the last year or two?
Anyway, so I ended up getting a mid-dawn job in a station, first FM station in Waikato. It was horrible. Did a journalism course at AIT, 18 weeks. These days, of course, they've made it 3 years and managed to con everybody into thinking that you get a job at the end of it. But nowadays, it was just 18 weeks, so I did that. And then I got a call from Radio New Zealand, the Broadcasting Corporation of New Zealand, who said, they'd been turning me down for years, and eventually they realised I was getting picked up by other stations, so they sent me to Wellington into a boarding house with six other men for a month to learn how to speak English correctly, to say Tuesday afternoon and not Tuesday afternoon, to say Wellington, not Wellington, and you know, how to pronounce French and German, and a 150-word speech in Maori. And then they sent me to Whanganui, which I was such a poser Auckland punk, I honestly did not know where it was, so I had to look on an atlas. Where the hell is Whanganui? Is it North or South Island? So I turned up in Whanganui with red-headed hair hanging over my eyes and shaved up the back of my head and three-quarter jeans and espadrilles, because I was in a Dixie's Midnight Runners phase, and eyeliner. And the only people aged 21 in Whanganui in those days were the meat workers and the police. Everybody else had got the hell out of town, so a few thrashings, I got rid of the hair color. and ended out in Radio New Zealand, and then ended up in Greymouth, community broadcaster, doing 2 to 7 in the afternoon, and a bit of journalism, a bit of everything. And that was the thing about Radio B. It taught you how to do everything. Write copy, produce stuff, make ads, you know, be an announcer, do everything. And so those small provincial stations, you know, great. And then that year in Whanganui, just to blow my own trumpet, I actually won Best New Broadcaster at the Radio Awards, which of course was a have, and I admit it now, and this is, you know, because I had already been working in radio for 2 years, but just not commercial radio. And then I became basically a radio gypsy. And I did Greymouth, and then I did Wellington on ZM. Then I came out to Radio Hauraki and did Drive, and that by that stage I thought, my God, I've made it. And then they, you know, put me back room, went overseas, went to London to get out of radio, and ended up working in an Indian radio station in Hounslow, West London, on their breakfast show. And was the star of a letter to The Guardian that said, can anyone tell me why an Australian is doing a breakfast show in English on an Indian radio station in London? So that lasted for a while. And then, and that was actually during the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And that was an amazing experience because all the Asians, and I say Asians as meaning proper Asians, Indians, Pakistanis, were working in Kuwait, and they were lost in the desert. They, you know, because of the war. And Richard Branson and our radio station combined to send jets in there to get them out, because they've been sending money home, you know. And so we did a charity concert at Wembley with electric Bhangra music, you know, and I was one of the MCs because I'm so electric Bhangra. And so I walk out on stage at Wembley and there's 60,000 people there, you know. And this was just, I forget, and you know, I don't want to mention another radio station, but Radio Tirana here, you know, that's got 5% ratings. You forget that there are little subsets of people, and that combined, they are massive. And that was great. Boom, 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 boom. Yeah, it was excellent. And then I saw an ad in a industry magazine for a English radio copywriter, actually, in Monte Carlo, in Monaco. There's an English station down there. So I went down, became the copywriter, and stayed there for 3 years in France, doing English radio. It ended up on air again within 2 weeks because I filled in and they went, hey, you're all right, and threw the other guy into copy. And then finally came home. And this is where another Radio B connection comes in, because when I got home in 92, Debbie Gibbs had just launched BBC World Service New Zealand, which was the BBC rebroadcaster with her. She was managing it on behalf of her dad and also managing the Fitz at the same time. And they needed someone who could be a journalist and do an afternoon show and produce Lindsay Perigo. So I did that. And again, a fascinating time because Rodney Hyde, Lindsay Perigo, Roger Douglas, Trevor DeClean would all come in and do their shows. And while they were sitting around the coffee table, thought, let's launch a political party. So I watched ACT being born. And you know, it was great, a couple of years. Then I launched my own news talk station called The Point, which a lot of people said, what was The Point? And I agree. We rated 0.1 or 0.2, but our 1,000 listeners loved it. And that was to beat News Talk ZB. But in the end, News Talk ZB bought me, laid me off, and then rehired me as a Classic Hits presenter because I'd reached that age. And I've been at Classic Hits, which will happen to us all, for 12 years, a year of Drive and 11 years of Breakfast. So
that's amazing.
And so I'm 46 now. I started when I was 18. I've done nothing but radio. I've had 10 weeks redundant and unemployed, and the rest of the time I've always had a job. And I remember at the Radio Awards a while back, I bumped into Marcus, who we went to the same primary school together, so I've known him for 40 odd years. And I said, God, it's amazing, you know, here we are in our 40s, and what has radio given us? And if it hadn't been for B, you know, this whole journey and Wembley, 60,000 people in Monaco, and I worked in Taipei and Taiwan as well. I forgot to mention that. You know, all those places all happened because I accidentally blundered into Radio B to play some punk rock. Some brilliant. Shut up. Let's play some Magazine. Love the song. I love that song because it's a Radio B album track, you know, and everyone I play it to who hasn't got the album will go, ah, they'll know Shot by Both Sides and they'll know, you know, Song from Under the Floorboards and other great magazine songs. But that one was one of those songs you used to play on Radio B when you were looking for something with a bit of colour and something different. And so you'd whack that on. And there was always loads of them because you go up and get the record collection out and you go through the whole album and go, ooh, that'll be my little signature tune when I get to this album, you know, and we play that. No, I found one the other day. I don't know who, if anyone ever remembers Tuxedo Moon and Desire. And that was another, it was a song. The only way I found that was by going through the records. And that's cool, you know. And there's an Annette Peacock song that I used to play all the time. And I used to play Flamingos from The Cure from Yes, Yes, Yes. Nobody else would play it, but, you know. The album tracks on B.
That was one of yours.
Yeah. I thought, you know, XTC and all those, slightly, and more Elvis Costello would make it onto the commercial playlist with the classic hit station. It hasn't happened. I have realized also that we do look at the songs, we do research them, and those songs aren't quite as mass as a lot of people would like to think it was. And I remember it at being in management at B, you did realize that if you were really going to be a student station, you should be playing Dire Straits. Well, you should. Because
that was what students liked.
That's what they liked.
Yeah.
And that's why they were listening to other stations. But the fact that we found a niche is fantastic and it suited me fine. But, yeah. I remember a terrible debate happening on there where I said, surely B should play just the greatest music ever recorded based on, sure, it's subjective, but, you know. So therefore, there should be no reason why A Day in the Life by the Beatles should not be played, or the Beatles should not be played. There was a storm of protest. Oh, how dare you, selling out. Blah, 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 blah. What do you know? You're in commercial radio now anyway. Blah, 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 blah. And I actually think that B's ended out there. And it is playing music on its merits and not on its look. And that keeps it fresh for me. That's really important to keep going. The Happy Punk Glee Club, rocking its way through all sorts of surreal situations. Yeah, and my last song is going to reflect that, because it's from the days when the Blues Squad used to come in and beat you all up at pubs and at parties. And of course, it was around when the Riot Squad was going through us in the Springbok Tour in 1981. But we were having a lot of fun, and we were listening to the Pneumatics as well. It's a happy song about some sad times.
You have been listening to the BFM Historical Society, a documentary radio series made to commemorate BFM's 40th anniversary. The Historical Society airs every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and is replayed as a podcast from BFM's website later on in the week. The BFM Historical Society is produced at BFM by Dubhead.